which is Thomas versus Sims. Mr. Bregman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Neil Bregman. I'm an associate with the law firm of Mayor Brown, Grill and Law. I represent the petitioner appellant in this case, Clarence Thomas. Petitioner is asking this court grant his writ of habeas corpus, holding that the Illinois appellate court's decision denying his direct appeal was contrary to an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, in this case, Kyler versus Sullivan. If time permits, I'd like to try and touch on three areas today for the court. First, why petitioner is entitled to relief under 2254 D1. And within that, I have two subpoints. The first is that the Illinois appellate court's articulation of Kyler was contrary to federal law because of the way it limited the standard. And second, that even if
even assuming that's true, what's hard to see is how any, you know, having his own lawyer would actually have affected his defense. We didn't really have a defense. Isn't that his problem?
He had a defense. His defense was that he was an innocent bystander.
I know, but that's sort of absurd, isn't it?
Well, if there was a trial at which, obviously if the co-defendant's testimony is eliminated and can't be used against Thomas, all that's left is a wallet that's found on his co-defendant. The victim saying the plastic gun that was used to hit him was the plastic gun that DuBose had, and Thomas' statement, and Thomas even in his own statement basically, you know, if we believe the police as far as the statement goes, says that he says let it alone, that he wasn't, you know, he was basically just an innocent bystander telling the other guy to leave the guy alone. In this case, the test used by the Illinois appellate court to analyze and review appellant and
effective... Didn't Thomas admit that he asked DuBose whether he'd need a weapon?
Well, the statement was given by a police officer. It wasn't given by Thomas.
Well, the police officer said that Thomas told him that, didn't he?
Correct.
Well, then there is a statement made by Thomas. Or by Sam. Did Sam say he had said anything to the police officer before the evidence?
I'm sorry, can you repeat
that? The statement Sims made going to the record.
I'm not sure. Sims is the warden.
Thomas.
Other than the statement that the police officer said attributes to Thomas, that's all that's in the record.
But the police officer said that Thomas told him certain things which put him in the case.
Yes, and it's Mr. Thomas's contention that that was not what he actually said.
Well, you're saying it wasn't, there's nothing that Thomas said is in the record, but you're saying there's Thomas didn't testify, but what he said was in the record.
If you believe what the police officer said,
that's what happened, isn't it? You believe the police officer.
I think it was...
As a fact, the police officer, when he said that Thomas told him that he was part of the action.
I think he believed the police officer because of not only that statement, but because it went in line with what DuBose statement was.
Whatever. The probability question was resolved that Thomas had said to the police officer so enough to get him in the case.
I think an unconflicted attorney would have been able to better cross-examine the police officer and make it such that the finder of fact would not have necessarily believed what Mr. Thomas' supposed confession was, especially given the other facts in the case.
There's something that a non-conflicted lawyer would do that caused the police officer to tell a different story than the one he told.
I don't think the story the police officer told would change, but the way the finder of fact would have looked at it would change, because... an unconflicted attorney would have said, look at the evidence, this is the co-defendant's the aggressor, it was the co-defendant...
But how about Thomas' statement, though, not the co-defendant's? It's Thomas' statement that the police officer...
No, there's a difference, we're not conceding that Mr. Thomas admits that what the police officer said is true, but there's a difference between some level of culpability and doing a direct action.
Oh, no, that I think is very weak. Once you have Thomas involved to the extent of just what the police officer said, then he's guilty.
Well,
it doesn't matter whether he, you know, hit him or change his mind later or what?
I think at the very least an unconflicted attorney could have put on some defense. It's not necessarily, the standard of the car is not necessarily defense that you have to win, that you have
to win. I don't know. The question is whether or not attacking the credibility of the police officer could have been done by somebody who had no prior probability. You could have to show the police officer lied about what Thomas told him.
I think aside from the state, the police officer, Mr. Thomas would have been able to take the stand and...
And contradict the police officer.
Yes.
Nickel bet.
At the very least,
that was a conflict. Suppose there was a conflict, why would that inhibit the lawyer in cross-examining the police officer?
Well, because I think that an unconflicted attorney would have seen that the best line of cross-examination would have been to show that the co-defendant was actually the only aggressor. They found the wall on him.
He's not the one who was lying when he told him about his participation.
Say again, I'm sorry?
And therefore, when Thomas told the police officer about his participation, Thomas was lying.
Well, the intention would either be that he was telling the police what he wanted to hear, but that's not our position. Rather, the position would be that Mr. Thomas didn't make those statements to the police.
Well, no, Thomas was a liar. That's what I'm pressing. I would approach that problem. Why else would one of the lawyers going to improve the credibility or disprove the credibility of the police officer's testimony? What's he going to say to wax the police officer?
Well, maybe he could point out inconsistencies in what he supposedly says DeBose says. The statements don't exactly jive.
Well, there's nothing to do with any credibility of the police officer. Does do with the credibility of the police
officer. If the police officer's making up a story here...
So you're going to put the police officer's a liar, is what you're saying. We get back.
That would be one line of defense that...
That would get rid of Thomas' statement to the police officer. I'm not going to show the police officer was a liar when he said the statement was made.
I can't think of any right now, Your Honor.
You can have
it. You know, we thought about it. If DeBose had his separate lawyer, he would have wanted to go after the police officer also. Because that police officer's testimony incriminates both of them.
Correct.
So if they had separate lawyers, both would be hammering at the police officer. If they had one lawyer, he hammers at the police officer. What difference does it make?
Well, I think he would be hammering at the police officer, but they would basically they're pointing the finger at each other, and Tom...
Because there is pointing his finger at both. So if they have one lawyer, or two lawyers, or 10 lawyers, they'll all try to demolish the police officer's statement.
But the approach by which they would demolish would be somewhat
that's
different.
That's what I don't see. I don't see that.
It would be different because Mr. DeBose had the gun and the round on him, and so he's going to have to say that Mr. Thomas is somehow the guy behind this.
I don't see what that has to do with the officer's testimony.
Well, if you go into the testimony, all that's left is...
Sure, but both of them have an interest in somehow getting the jury to disbelieve the police officer's testimony.
Well, the line of questioning that one attorney would have asked about would have...
I don't get it. You want to show the police... Both defendants want to show the police officer somehow fabricated this story because he incriminates both of them.
I think you could show the inconsistencies in the two of their statements and show that the problem was that a unconflicted attorney would have been able to point and show, well, look, it's DeBose. It's not just the confession. An unconflicted attorney would have been able to put other sorts of evidence up, or at least investigate other evidence. Very quickly, Your Honors, we believe that the Illinois Appellate Court's articulation of the standard to analyze this case under is incorrect because it articulated Kyle as requiring a defendant to show an actual conflict of interest manifested at trial.
It's not obvious that if you have two people who have probably in all likelihood have joined in this crime, that having them each point the finger at the other is an effective mode of defense. If they had separate lawyers, you could come up in here and say, well, this is a disaster having separate lawyers, because each of them convinced the judge that the other was guilty, so they're both guilty. Whereas if they had one lawyer, he could have, you know, stonewalled the judge and undermined the evidence against them. And
well, that wasn't necessarily the best defense for Mr. Thomas, though, given the physical evidence in the case and the testimony of the victim, which showed that DeBose was the one who hit the victim.
It doesn't matter who hit him.
Well, this, at the very least, he could have made arguments showing the weakness in the cases between the two. And if he's conflicted, he can't...
They're both guilty, but one is guiltier than the other, what you say.
There's a difference between culpability...
One is more guilty than the other?
No, Mr. Thomas is not guilty.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bregman. Ms. Osterberger?
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Domenica Osterberger. I'm an assistant Illinois attorney general, and I represent the warden in this cause. It's the defendant's...
How is it that in Illinois state court that two defendants are represented by one lawyer?
The defendants have the right to have the same lawyer if they want to. And if you look at the framework that the Supreme Court articulated in Cairo v. Sullivan, it says that when there is no objection made...
That's a presumption of the problem.
There is no per se problem with having one lawyer representing two defendants. And Cairo v. Sullivan says that unless the trial judge knew or reasonably should have known that there would be a conflict of interest, the trial judge...
Can you remember it at all?
The trial judge?
Uh-huh.
That is not evident from the record that's before the court. The actual transcripts of the state court trial are not before the court. There are just the exhibits that were filed with respect to the answers from the disposition and the petition itself, which were obviously the appellate briefs and the appellate decision.
So there's nothing in the record to show that the parties were cautioned that by having the same lawyer might create a problem?
No. Hmm. So the defendant...
Was the trial record before the Illinois appellate court?
Certainly.
Certainly? Why isn't it before this court?
Well, Green v. Greer is this court's decision, which says that the district court judge need not have the trial court record before him in order to effectively rule upon the habeas claims. The reason why is because Rule 5, it's twofold. The habeas statute itself, even prior to the AEDPA, says that the factual determinations of the state court are presumed to be correct on habeas. And it is up to, Green v. Greer tells participants in habeas proceedings that it is up to the petitioner to demonstrate that there's some type of inaccuracy or inadequacy with respect to the state court appellate decision that would require the district court to go ahead and order that.
Is there anything in the appellate decision about what the trial judge said about the joint representation?
My reading of the appellate court's decision is that this issue was not raised at all in the trial court, Your Honor. And that's why it was analyzed under Cairo v. Sullivan, which brings me back to one of the earlier questions of the court, which is that Cairo teaches us that there is no per se problem with one attorney representing two defendants. And in fact, when the issue is not raised in the trial court, the reviewing court is not going to presume that there is a problem as well. The reason why the reviewing court is not going to presume that there's a problem with that is because there are two alternate reasonable explanations for that. Number one, counsel has an ethical obligation to determine if there is a conflict of interest, or a divided loyalties issue, I should say, that would have precluded the dual representation. And the court is going to defer to counsel's assessment of that situation and his undertaking of representing two defendants. The second reason, the alternate reason, is perhaps everyone was aware, counsel and the defendants themselves, as to the possibility of conflict, but they went ahead and accepted the risk. That's the underlying principle under Cairo v. Sullivan's requirement that in order for a petitioner to succeed in raising this conflict of interest issue for the first time in appeal, that he has to show that there's an adverse effect on counsel's performance.
Was this retained counsel?
It appears that it was retained counsel. There is language that indicates that counsel was hired. Cairo v. Sullivan says that there's no difference between hired counsel or appointed counsel in this regard. I'd like to touch on some of the issues that my opponent had argued before you, because it's his burden to show that there was an adverse effect on performance here. He has posited a theory that the police officer who testified regarding the two statements of the defendant could have possibly been cross-examined in a different way, but he certainly hasn't demonstrated how. It appears that he's arguing before the court today that what he really had wanted to have done was to demonstrate that the police officer was lying in some fashion, but there's absolutely no suggestion as to how on earth he could have shown that the police officer was lying. There's no support for that in the record. And the arguments that counsel offered this morning with respect to what other questions could have been asked about the differences between the statements really would not have been appropriate questions to ask the police officer. Counsel was suggesting to the court this morning that the police officer should have been asked about the differences and distinctions between the statements of each of the co-defendants. Well, the officer's opinion regarding the differences between statements isn't relevant. The officer was simply testifying as to the facts. The facts are that you both said one thing and that the petitioner said the other thing. Which brings me to another point, which is that counsel was savvy enough in the trial court to object at this joint bench trial to the use of these statements against each defendant. So effectively, the petitioner can't come into this court and argue that somehow DuBose's statement was considered against him. Counsel precluded that from happening at this joint bench trial. The other thing that counsel had argued in his brief with respect to the possibility of adverse performance here was a suggestion that perhaps counsel should have stressed certain things during closing arguments. Given the fact that this is a bench trial, counsel was free to do whatever he had wanted to.
If this were a jury trial, wouldn't you suggest that our examination would be more stringent in terms of joint representation?
It very well could have been, Your Honor, because the jury, unlike the judge, the jury is not going to be able to presume that shouldn't be considered against each other. So
we presume the trial judge always considered statements.
That's right. We presume that trial judges have the ability to distinguish between the legal and factual support for each individual defendant's
evidence
of authority.
This
right, exactly. It would have been in an entirely different posture if this was a jury trial.
Yeah, okay.
Does President Warner have access to the trial record, Illinois State Court trial record?
I have no idea. You'll have to
I have a tremendous problem because I'm looking at the thing, but one judge has to have a no, so I'm not actually trial
document, isn't it?
No.
In the Illinois Circuit Court?
Yes.
Or anyone could go and look at it?
Yes. And that's why frequently we on behalf of the state, come before the courts and say, yes, we know that we're obligated to provide those portions of the state court record which we believe in our professional judgment are needed to assess the habeas case, but we're not required to provide the whole thing. And if the petitioner wanted to go ahead and supplement whatever he had wanted to in the district court, he very well could have done that. But he didn't do that. The petitioner's argument in his brief is a complaint about the record, and his brief is a complaint that somehow the state dropped the ball and didn't file the state court record here.
Is the transcript part of the record, I think? Are you going to have to pay for it, is what I'm asking.
No, the transcript, I do not have transcripts. I have not seen the transcripts, Your Honor. Typically, all the transcripts of the state court proceedings are in fact part of the record and stored away. That's what usually happens. So, but again, the state, when we filed our answer and filed our exhibits in support of our answer to this habeas petition, followed the protocol that was established in Green v. Greer. If the district court judge had wanted the record, he could have very well ordered it if the petition had demonstrated that it was needed in some way. My final point that I wanted to make with respect to petitioner's claim about the contrary to aspect of 2254 D1 is that I had an argument more recent, in fact, that the state trial court did articulate the proper standard of Kyler v. Sullivan. But even if the state appellate court did not articulate the proper standard of Kyler v. Sullivan, petitioner is not entitled to relief. All he would be entitled to then be some type of plenary review by the federal court of the claim itself, the conflict of interest claim itself, which obviously would be done without making deferential considerations to the state court. If I do have time, I do have one final point I wanted to make, that there is a factual dispute with respect to whether or not petitioner raised the conflict of interest claim in this direct appeal. some good follow-up from different positions in which you raised a whole host of claims regarding counsel's ineffectiveness at the trial level. The post-conviction petition does not contain an allegation regarding the conflict of interest. Petitioner's brief suggests that it does. I would argue to the court that it doesn't, just that exhibit F. I would be happy to answer any further questions that the court has.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Osterberg. Mr. Brady, your time expired. We'll give you a minute.
On the issue of the record, Your Honor, Rule 5 of Rule 7 habeas cases does have permissive language as far as what the Attorney General should find necessary to give to the court. But in this case, Fisher has been pro se, and for the burden to be put on him to know what should be done.
You have access, you said.
I have read the court transcript.
Thank you.
Other than that, this case has never been analyzed under Kyle v. Sullivan. It wasn't analyzed under Kyle v. Sullivan by the district court, and it wasn't analyzed under Kyle v. Sullivan in the Illinois appellate court. We therefore ask that you grant the writ and, in the alternative, remand this case for an evidentiary hearing where we can get the trial transcripts and allow the district court to analyze under the proper standards. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goldman, and thank you for accepting the appointment.